Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today we're joined by James Fallon, a diagnosed psychopath who happens to be the leading neuroscientist on psychopaths. In his book, The Psychopath Within, which is part memoir and part pop science book, Fallon discovers that he has the same brain scan as serial killers like Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer. But unlike those evil men, Fallon is a pro-social psychopath who doesn't have violent impulses. We talk about the different layers and degrees of psychopathy and will prove that just because you have no conscience doesn't mean you can't contribute to society. Why are we as a society so scared of psychopaths? And how can we learn to identify them and coexist with them in a productive, safe way? Where does it come from? And is it curable? There are more questions than answers when it comes to the scariest psychological phenomena. So we're going to go not only to one of its leading scientists, but to one of its victims. James, welcome.
Dr. Gluck, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I want to thank you for coming on my show. It's going to be a great show. We really have a lot of interest in it.
Well, thanks for the invitation. I listened to some of your recent ones. They were kind of really interesting. I don't know how you put up with some of it.
Anyway. It's not always that easy.
Oh, yeah. And the thing with Fetzer was, how you talk about somebody who's just screaming at you. I mean, how did... It's unbelievable. I thought you were quite good with him, but I know a fair number of people, and I've had a blog for many years, among maybe about 50 of us, of all sorts of people, really left, right wing, libertarian, and moderate, but they all seem to be like that. They're kind of bullies that try to shout down everybody, and they can be from the far left or far right. It almost doesn't matter. But it was very reminiscent of some of my friends.
What I call it is people who just play tennis and they don't play catch. They don't know how to catch the ball and just throw it back gently. They just want to hit the ball back before they even process it.
Yeah, it was pretty funny with his wife in the background. So they must have a relationship, And it's but if you just have a listen with somebody, of course it's. You can just let them go. You just let them talk. You got a show to run. It's most people just sit there drumming their fingers and just let them gas out, as it were.
So I want you to start off by actually defining a psychopath. Actually, most people, when they think of psychopath, they think of a Dahmer. They think of someone who doesn't fit into society, who is actually void of anything. So give us a clinical and a pragmatic definition of psychopath, how it's defined, and how you would define yourself.
Well, Errol, the term psychopath is really controversial. It doesn't really exist as such in psychiatry, in the official DSM-5, and the term sociopath was gotten rid of back in 68. And it's, part of the problem is it doesn't, it overlaps with other entities like narcissism and even some sadism and so there's a lot of overlap. So it's really controversial. What's accepted as the closest thing in psychiatry is antisocial personality disorder, ASPD, which is one of the 10 personality disorders. And that has an extremely negative connotation, as does any term associated with psychopath. But if you look at the original definition, it goes back to the 40s by the author Cleckley, who's a psychiatrist. And he looked at a psychiatric population and came up with a very useful, and it still holds today, definition of psychopath. That is the traits involved. And those people are not usually criminals. He wasn't studying criminals. What's popular today, it was really popularized by Robert Hare, his psychopathy checklist from the 90s on, it's very useful. But he was really focused on the criminal population, and it was done on male adult criminals. And then it was expanded to include teenagers and females. And so there's these, if you think of the five Olympic rings, let's say, as overlapping rings, one of the rings would be this ASPD. And one of the overlapping rings would be criminality. And another one would be hairs, two factors. And the first factor has to do with how you treat people, how you interact socially with people. And the other one is more like ASPD, and it's a more dangerous sort of thing. It's a parasitic lifestyle, very poor behavioral controls, and a criminal background. It's starting early on. Now, with all that proviso, you can say that it's a psychopath, in plain language, is somebody who really has no respect for others as individuals, other people. And they use people. It doesn't mean they kill them. It doesn't mean they have to rape them, but they use other people as objects. And one of the primary cardinal traits of this is a lack of empathy. And it's not a lack of cognitive empathy. That is, they can have cognitive empathy. They know what you're thinking, but they don't feel it. And that feeling empathy is called emotional empathy. And that's the one that most people associate with empathy. That is, you actually feel somebody else's pain and their pleasure, and you can really identify with them. Psychopaths don't have that. So one of the cardinal things is this lack of emotional empathy. But they have cognitive empathy, which doesn't help you because they know what you're thinking and feeling. And so they can use that, and their feelings don't get in the way. So they can be very quick in processing. They can be in very good predators because of that, because they don't have their feelings getting in the way of their thinking. So that's one sort of idea. The other is, and this is covered in what's called a PPI. It's a psychopathology checklist that's somewhat like the hair, but it's broken down into what's called fearless dominance. And impulsive antisociality. The fearless dominance is an important one because this is the one that is called the pro-social aspect of psychopathy. So a pro-social psychopath,
which you would be, correct?
Yes, yes. And it's interesting. A paper came out about a year and a half ago, a scientific paper, where all the biographers of American presidents were looked at with this PPI and this one major part of psychopathy, this fearless dominance, and they were ranked. And at the top of the list, this pro-social psychopathy, was Teddy Roosevelt, then FDR, then JFK. Bill Clinton was, I think, number five. And way at the bottom of the list are people like Jimmy Carter.
Right, right.
You know, the Menches, who very, you know, peace-loving, you know, in a way that's, you know, passive, let's say. And so the interesting thing about this is that the way people, the average person, the voter, ranks them as leaders, associates almost very closely with this fearless dominance. So we vote in people with this. So it's an attractive trait for leadership. Doesn't mean you're criminal, but you have this boldness about you and social dominance and this charm and physically fearless and very immune to anxiety. So you're very hard to catch in a lie because you don't have any tells when you lie.
See, that, by the way, was one of the reasons which I love the book, because what it does is that, for me, it allows people to understand that labels are far more extensive than what they appear to be. What you just described in your description kind of fits most psychiatrists, half the lawyers, and definitely 90% of the politicians.
Exactly. And so it's something, and people wonder, why do we have, in every culture, you know, 1-2%, why are psychopaths still around? Well, they're the people who have this fearless sort of dominance, and we interpret that as leadership. And so in the case of somebody like FDR and some other presidents who lied to us, but they lied for us to protect us, you know what I mean? And so we allow that to happen. And you know, if the person who's investing for us is making us money, we tend not to complain so much, right? And so I think that people may fool themselves into thinking that they really hate everything about psychopathy because they really vote a lot of people into office. But, you know, you rarely see a full-blown categorical psychopath that has both these positive and these negative traits, the real the full-blown one, as leaders and as CEOs of major corporations. They just don't – they can't stick around and focus on that, and they usually get caught. But what you do see that, you know, for example, small companies, you know, let's say small biotech or day traders, you tend to see full psychopathy. And so, you know, the Wolf of Wall Street, if you really listen to him talk, and it's...
It was clear to me. Actually, I saw the movie the other night. I'm curious, Jim, is Obama, in your eyes professionally, is he a psychopath?
Well, we don't know. He's one that, because his, you know, not enough time has gone by. You know, he's still a president. We don't know if there is pathological lying going on. I mean, people would suspect it and everything. And what that lying means, you know, why is somebody lying? Are they lying?
You could keep your health care if you want it. I promise you, if you have health care, you could keep it. That's kind of lying.
Well, that's the thing. Is he lying or not? We don't know that yet, and we don't know if it's a lie, the basis of it. You know, it's like, well, if it doesn't happen, then somebody's going to drop a bomb on everybody. So you just don't know. But I think in the fullness of time, we'll know this. It's just that nobody's been able to rate him because we don't really know that information yet.
A pro-social psychopath. Now, let's look at yourself. When did you discover that you were a psychopath? And doesn't, you know, in reading your book, didn't you, though, show signs of anxiety and fear? And also, it did seem like you had some empathetic feelings towards family and relationships. But you tell me.
Yes, Errol, I really found out in a flurry of after a couple of years, after I was looking at all these scans for the past 15-18 years of murderers, impulsive murderers, psychopathic murderers, et cetera, and was analyzing PET scans, SPECT scans, et cetera, of them. And I just happened to be involved in, we were doing a study on the genetics and imaging of Alzheimer's disease, and we needed controls, and I was a control in that, because we needed controls, we had all the experimentals. And after I had that analyzed, this whole pile came in, and I looked at it, and I went through, because there were no names on it, because we keep it, you know, blinded. And I saw this scan at the bottom of the pile, and I told the technician, I said, you get this in the wrong pile. This is obviously one of the murders. This is a psychopathic, you know, full-blown psychopath pattern.
And it was yours.
And it turns out to be mine. It was like, you know, it's a Gandalf shows up at your door and it's you, you know, you take notice. And, you know, I just laughed at it. And the technicians, they kind of were just a little giddy about it, too. And I just really didn't think anything of it. And we were so busy with some other things. I'd started an adult stem cell company for stroke and we were working on schizophrenia and all that. So I just kind of just laughed it off. And it was only when the genetics came back, which I turned out to have of the about 30 genetic alleles, forms of genes, that are highly associated with psychopathy, that it became, I said, well, geez, I got both these biological markers for psychopathy. And it was only after I went to Oslo to give a talk with the ex-prime minister about the bipolar disorder, and I gave a public talk with him and a clinician on it, that the psychiatrists in the audience, they looked at my genetics and my scans, and they said, first of all, you don't even know it, but you were bipolar yourself. And second of all, I met with them afterwards, you know, at a party afterwards at the president of the university's house, and they said, you're probably psychopathic. That's when I started to go, something's amiss here. And that was only a few years ago. And when I came back to Southern California, I started asking the psychiatrist who knew me really well for years and knew my behaviors really well. I said, tell me what you think of me, really. And they said, well, we've been telling you for years, you have all these psychopathic traits. And I said, no. You said I was crazy. They said, we didn't say you're crazy. You're not crazy, but you have all these psychopathic traits. And they went through each one of them. And over the years, and when it was all in front of me, and they all, you know, they really agreed on this, they said, you're not a full-blown, you're kind of a borderline psychopath. And when I took the test, you know, the hair test, and when I did the PPI, it came out the same way. They're all very consistent. Then I talked to my family. I said, you got to be truthful with me. And my very close friends over the years, for a long time, and they all said the same thing. And I said, and so that's the first time I took it seriously. But after I found out, Errol, I didn't care. And one of the psychiatrists said, see, that's the point. And so that was when I really found out. It was only, I would say, about 2.5-3 years ago when it fully hit me.
I wonder whether or not we have everything turned around, because for the most part, from I've been doing executive life coaching and clinical hypnosis for 37 years. For the most part, most people's anxiety and fears and phobias come because they care too much about what other people think. That's what I cure. The ability not to care, and to have a sense of, you know, your own compass of what you want to accomplish, as long as it's not inherently self-destructive to someone else, and it is pro society in the sense you're contributing, is to me, you know, the best thing in the world someone could have. So it's almost as if we've turned everything upside down.
Yeah, I don't see it as really a negative thing. In fact, I use it, I think, to a great advantage. It helps drive me to win. And since, I mean, this is one of the things, I've had the good fortune of having grown up in a really wonderful family, extended family. And
did you love them, Jim? Did you feel close to them?
I did. As a kid, I was very happy-go-lucky, and then I went through an extremely dark phase, which my mother finally told me about. She's 96 now, and she was, she said, I've never told anybody this, and she told me how strange I got, and it wasn't the normal sort of thing of a kid going through puberty. It was protracted. It lasted a long time. It was very intense. And compared to what I was, I went very dark, she said. And she was going to have the psychiatrist friend of ours talk to me. But at the time, you know, back in 1960, that was a no-no. That's like finding out your parents were divorced or something. You know, it was that crazy then. And she didn't. But I think she told, because she was a teacher and she had, you know, a very large family. I think she told the other teachers, et cetera, why don't you make sure this guy doesn't get into trouble? And she kept me very, I was busy, and I was fortunate that I was, at the time, I look like hell now, but at the time, you know, as a teenager, I was, you know, good looking. I was a really good athlete, involved all the time in all sorts of things, student government and acting and four sports a year. And I did well in school, and I was popular and funny, and so I was able to navigate without having to resort to anything. Do you know what I mean? I was just
I absolutely do. I'm just trying to figure out, what did she see that was dark? You sound like you were successful. Meaning, what was the darkness that came out? What did it look like?
It looked like a depression. It looked like dread and what would be considered in an adult schizotypal behavior. That is, I went way inside, didn't talk to anybody, and I went from being very social. You know, it was the contrast of what I was, and then over like a 6-month period, went into this grand funk. And you know, I had OCD for, you know, full blown OCD. I was hyper religious, and I was, you know, back in New York in our diocese in Albany, you know, I was the Catholic boy of the year, and got to meet Nelson Rockefeller because of that for some reason. But at any rate, I was this very devout kid who went deeper and deeper into this hyper-religious state. But then on top of it, I went into this funk that seemed unrelated to it. You know what I mean? It may not have been unrelated to it. And then when I went back to school and got involved like day and night in all these activities, I kind of came out of it. But once I hit my late teens, my whole very positive, very good, you know, angelic sort of behavior, it really kind of went dark again. That is, I went from being hyper-moral to really becoming completely amoral. Again, that happened at a time when, you know, in late teens, when your frontal cortex starts really maturing. And all the monoamines are layered correctly. And that's when things like, you know, schizophrenia come out and some kinds of depression and other things. But it's when you mature. And so people do go through a change then. But they can't, not every kid integrates their emotional world with their intellectual world, okay? And I guess in psychoanalytic terms, it's when you finally unite the ego, superego, and id. And they become, integrated. Well, mine flipped all the way the other way. It was like I became an id machine, you know? And it wasn't because of any suppression, because I was never suppressed or oppressed by religion or
So Catholicism did not have that effect on you.
And oh, again, no.
Again, sorry.
You know, Errol, this is a funny one, because, you know, when I used to go to confession every week and mass every day, and the priest that's kind of shepherded me throughout that time, he goes, "You're taking it too seriously, man." And he says, "These are not sins," because I would have sins against the symmetry of the universe and all this crazy stuff as an OCD person would have. And it was, and my parents and everybody in religion, they never put the kibosh on it. The Catholic Church, in the sense of the people that I met over the years, were very supportive. And here was the wild thing. I went to a Catholic college in Vermont, St. Michael's College, and there a priest, I mean, he saw the issue because I think he was having doubts himself, but we became good friends, and he's the guy when I was 19 that gave me a last confession. He says, "You don't need the church. You don't need any church. It's not helping you." And he actually un-Catholic-ed me. You know what I mean? He's the one that got me out of that. Not the Catholic Church per se, but all this hyper-religiosity.
He should write a book.
He should write. Oh, he was just a wonderful guy because, you know, priests are not supposed to talk kids out of being a Catholic, right? But he, you know, after talking, he said, "This is the best thing for you." So I felt all through my years that the people that I ran across in the Catholic Church, the nuns, the priests, and everything, were very, very supportive and would try to cool my jets in terms of this hyper-religiosity.
When you, again, just so we see the picture, when you went into the other direction and became, quote-unquote, amoral, what did that actually look like? Now, you never went to the criminal side, correct?
Right. I did things that now would be considered, you know, now would be considered no-nos. I mean, from very early on, when I was a kid, you know, right around 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, I used to make explosives. We used to make pipe bombs and blow them up, me and this other friend. And we got involved in something, you know, stealing cars and breaking into houses. But we'd always return it, and we made sure that, you know, we didn't want to, you know, it was like a lark. Everything was a lark. And so I think the stuff that I did then, which, you know, when you set off recordings of 20 atom bombs going off in your high school, and when you fill the high school pool full of lobsters and fizzies, these were pranks at that time. Now these would be considered really a juvie type behavior, you know? And so it was at the time in our society where if you made pipe bombs and blew them up and you hung around people who started fires, et cetera, you know, grass fires, that it was considered, well, he's just interested in chemical engineering. You know, it was kind of put in those ways. And whenever we would get caught for anything, especially in college, because I used to, you know, I was like John Belushi, very much so. And whenever I get caught, the police, I'd always make them laugh, and they'd always let me go, even afterwards, into graduate school and my postdoc years, because I did wild things. And I would get them to laugh, and I showed no anxiety. So when I was confronted, I showed no guilt or anxiety because I didn't feel it. And they would all just laugh it off, so I never got into trouble, even though I was involved in things.
So is that part of the psychopathic behavior, is the ability to manipulate people and make them feel comfortable with you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, for the what's called a primary psychopath, and that's really the one that seems to very early on, there's some genetic component very early on. These are the people who are, they don't respond to punishment or apprehension or disapproval or stress, and they can inhibit their antisociality to get what they want. And they don't feel any genuine emotion. These people, the primary psychopaths, are the ones that can be very dangerous, whereas the secondary psychopaths, which is what most people think of as a sociopath, is more driven by environmental influences. These are people who have been beaten up, bullied, and they're getting even with the world, but they're not primary real psychopaths. And those people do worry. They do react to stress. They do have guilt. They do feel bad. So it's not real psychopathy. It's what people consider now sociopathy. But here are the dangerous ones. If you're a primary psychopath, that you can divide it also into what's called a distempered psychopath. And those are the ones, it's usually men who are hypersexual and go into a rage. And they usually get caught, though. They usually end up in the prison system. But the other kind is called a charismatic psychopath. And those are the charming ones. They're the very attractive and liars. And they can manipulate people very well. They're fast talkers. And they're almost demonic. So the primary psychopaths who are charismatic and who are, in a lot of them, are not criminal per se. He's pro-social, can manipulate anybody and not show any stress. So you can't read it in their body language or their eyes that they're lying or manipulating you because they're not feeling it themselves. There is no anxiety. It's a game. And so a lot of times the psychopaths that you run into or the borderline pro-socials, they're playing with you just because it's fun. And not necessarily to get sex from you or money from you. You see, and so people run into them, and they're playing a game. It's you know, everybody lies. It's under some circumstances, but when you're lying, just because you like to lie, and you know, if you look at you know the some analysis of Bill Clinton, it's like he was doing things that guys do, but he went beyond that because he was doing it when it was unnecessary, and he put a lot of people at risk and didn't seem to care. That's when you're getting more into what would be a primary psychopath. I'm not saying Bill Clinton's a psychopath, but he has those traits of some of the traits of the pro-socials. And they're very charming, and they get the light around them when they come into the room, and people love them. And especially women will go for that because it looks like they're leaders.
Jim, but haven't you, in a sense, described so many people in the military, so many people in the security field, national security field, so many people in rock stars and music and in movies? They would all fit under that category.
Yeah, the Errol, if you look at those jobs where these people can be hidden because it's part of the job. You know, if you have a job that is part that really you expect somebody to be act like this, then you can hide in that system, and that's part of the mask is finding a place. That's what psychopaths, primary psychopaths, pro-socials, that can navigate their way through a business or an organization and find that spot where they can get their jollies. That is, do these things and manipulate and have this power without getting caught. So it's not they want to become president. They don't want to necessarily become the general, but they find a power spot and then and they know exactly when they're there and they can. Their behaviors are hidden by the job itself.
Now this is what confuses me about you, James. What you described is this is a person who can in fact not have these feelings of anxiety and tension and depression, and yet be very goal-oriented and be a chameleon-like and just kind of change themselves. But you yourself have suffered from panic attacks. Now, isn't that a form of intense anxiety?
Well, it's, as you know, panic attacks and anxiety attacks are very different. And anxiety attacks is when you're in a situation that will produce an anxiety reaction, that there's a stimulus there, an environment that will stimulate it. Panic attacks can happen in the middle of the night when you're alone. They spontaneously, you just explode. And they're not linked to anything. And I've had about 900. They started when I was about 18 or 19. I think this is when my brain was really kind of switching.
You actually counted them, Jim?
Well, I've gone through, yeah, you start to count them because they, I looked at, I would average about three a week, and I went through a 10-year period where they were just didn't stop. It wasn't a regular thing, but it averaged about 3 weeks. So I figured from that, and then they kind of petered out. And once I knew how to control the heart rate and blood pressure spiking, because your blood pressure and heart rate goes completely berserk. It's a stroke level, so it can be dangerous that way. And with panic attacks, you are certain you're going to die within a minute. Every time. So the last one didn't matter, even though I know it wasn't true. I was convinced that I was, that you're convinced you're going to die, but it was never linked to anything. I've never had them when I've been giving, talks in front of large groups or interviews or anything, but it'll happen. I could be alone sitting in my jacuzzi and all of a sudden, bang, 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 and without any particular antecedent thoughts. And anxiety attacks are different because they are linked to a clear stimuli. So, this panic attack thing is a, temporal lobe serotonin related thing. And I do have actually the alleles for them in the temporal lobe problems over the years with that. So I think this, it's quite different. But, you know, I could be stopped for doing something or being caught red-handed doing something that I'm not supposed to. I'm not a thief, but caught red-handed behaviorally. And just act like nothing is wrong, and then you just can't read it. And so there, it's a bit different.
You shared something personal that I want to talk about. You've been married for decades, but you mentioned that you never felt fully connected to your wife, Diana. And you said that your kids are more like friends. Explain more and tell me what that feels like.
Well, if you're in your own skin, it's hard to know this until somebody points out that you may be a certain way. And so once I looked at my behavior, what I did was once I found out from people close to me and all these, you know, psychiatrists, what I had, I then went back and looked at all my behaviors with some psychiatrists and with my family. And if you look at the actual behavior, it tells a different story. Because, of course, I feel that I love my wife and all that. But I do things with my family, and, you know, my brothers and sisters, my parents, that I would just blow them off if there was a party going on. And I would just I had the behavior somebody really didn't care, even though I thought I did. And so when I looked in very carefully over a couple of years, in the past few years, looked at people I know very well and how they treated people, I looked at their actual behavior, how they treated their wife and their children, and the sacrifices they made. And people, it became clear to me that people make great sacrifices every day, and I could see those little micro behaviors, and I realized I don't do any of that. And it was those micro behaviors that I didn't see because I had the story that I loved, you know, I had, you know, true love and all of that. But and even though I felt that, my behavior did not prove that out. And so then, you know, I'm enough of a narcissist that 2 years ago I said to myself, I can beat this. I said, I know that you can't overcome psychopathy as an adult. You just don't get over it. It's not something that's cured, curable, so far. And I said, but I can beat it. I mean, that's how confident I am. So I said, what I'll do is I'll try to change my behavior, starting with my wife. And so what I started to do was, before I interacted with her, in very simple things, it could be who gets the glass of wine first, who gets served first, who picks up, and do you go, instead of when you go to meet her, do instead go to a bar where there's a bunch of people or friends, little things like that. And I realized that at every time, my natural instinct was to do the most selfish thing imaginable, even though it wasn't like, didn't look evil, but I was doing it constantly. And I realized that in interactions with the people, with my family, that's what I was doing. And it started with my wife, and that's when I kind of knew, because I just said, look at this. You know, it's like just being cognizant of that moment before you're about to be involved in a simple behavior. And I always do the most selfish thing. So I've been trying to not do that. And it's interesting for my wife and for, you know, my kids and my close friends, especially too. They can see it and they say they like it. They like that I'm trying to do it. And I tell them, I said, you know, it's not really sincere, and they don't care. And this is very hard for me to believe. But it's true. They just want me to treat them better.
Of course, they don't care, because people care about how they experience life for themselves. They don't necessarily care about motivation. If you give them a smile and a gift and you tell them, you know what, I really appreciate you, you know, as long as they feel what they want to feel, the sincerity level that it's coming from, unless you point it out that I really don't feel it. But you know what's interesting is that just like in the first year of nursing school or medical school, every single person, the thousands who are going to listen to this podcast, are going to go to their husbands and wives and saying, you know what? You're a psychopath. I'm a psychopath. Okay? And the question that I have is that so many people seem to actually fit this definition. Are we in danger of simply defining people who are inherently self-absorbed and somewhat narcissistic and giving this label? And do people have the maturity to actually deal with the label, meaning when most people hear that, they want to hide their kids. And obviously, you know, you sound like a great guy who I'd love to hang out and have a drink with. How do we protect society from overinterpreting this definition?
Errol, that's a great point. You know, when people look through that whole checklist, the psychopathy checklist, like the Robert Hare one, and they'll see things like glibness, superficial charm, grandiose sense of self-worth, conning, manipulated. Well, I mean, if somebody is a salesman, everybody expects them to do this. It's part of their job. And so we allow those things. And it's not considered psychopathic at all. But also, everybody has these behaviors, but they only do it when they really have to do it. Do you know what I mean? To protect themselves or their family, they may turn on the charm, or they're trying to, you know, pick somebody up, and they're over, you know, they're glib and charming and all the stuff like that. That's not psychopathy. Psychopathy is when you do it over and over and over again, and the situation, the context, the social context does not call for it. And so once you put that the understanding on it, then all of those behaviors, everybody does those things, right? But it usually is in a very understandable context. But, you know, in somebody, like for me, I don't pathologically lie, but I pathologically tell the truth with all stories that I have. I've had a fairly interesting life, like I'm sure you have, and many people have had. And I use it, but I don't use it to illuminate. I use it to manipulate people. And it's the manipulation for no reason other than to control the world of, you know, if you're in a group for 10 minutes or an hour, 2 hours, that is not normal behavior if you do it all the time, this need to control and this need to manipulate. And so that's different than just doing it when it's, you know, when it makes sense.
But you're actually making my point, Jim, because when most people hear the word manipulate, they think, oh, my God, that's evil. When I hear it, I see it as a very positive thing, depending upon the manipulator. You know, in coaching, you manipulate a person in order to believe, first of all, more in themselves and to be less influenced by people who are trying to bring them down or have a negative perception of them. So for me, the concept of manipulation is simply moving things around in order to place it in a better position to be responded to in a better way.
Your motives, Errol, your motives, it's a technique. Your motives are good, and your motives have a point to them. They're instrumental in getting somebody to see themselves and perhaps change for the good. That's not psychopathic at all. It's manipulation, but it's not psychopathic. And if you were doing it just to play with people's heads all the time, then it would be.
I got it. So the idea is it's the motive. So now let's go to you. Do you do it to play with people's heads, or are you trying to do some good?
I always told myself that it's just, you know, I was a class clown, and I'm doing it for fun, and other people will enjoy this. And people, you know, once I actually asked them a few years ago, you know, what they thought of me and the behavior, I found out I was really hurting people. And I didn't know how much I was hurting them. Because I hurt them in a, I guess maybe in a clever way, but it still can be devastating. And I didn't have the sense that I was doing it for that. But I knew that I was manipulating people for fun. And so I was being irresponsible. And the irresponsibility, can you forgive that? You know, if I thought I was hurting people, I would say there's no way I would do that. But I was, and so, you know, at that little sliver of, you know, self-realization, where you say, you knew you were hurting people, but you did it anyway because you wanted to get a jag. It was fun, and you did it. And I think that happened a number of times where I really knew that, but I said, the hell with it. I'll do it anyway. So at the very least, what I was doing was highly irresponsible, but not pernicious. You know, I never would think, oh, I'm doing this to be mean or to get something from them. Or, you know, I just wanted to own people. I always want to own them, just even for the moment. I want to create a world that they'll come into. You know, it's like having my own radio show all the time. And people know this, and they laugh at it. And enough people are up, you know, they know what I'm doing, and they just kind of laugh it off. But other people, and I've had people tell me this, they say, you know, Jim, people really believe you. You got to be careful. And I go, the hell. But people who know me they can sniff it coming a mile away, and they just laugh at me.
Now, Jim, do you cheat on your wife?
No.
Why not?
Well, I sort of get enough of my life to satisfy me. Do you know what I mean?
Enough stimulation going on that it's not really in the top 10 things that stimulate.
Oh,
you.
Absolutely not. Yeah, it just isn't. It's not that I'm asexual, but I really have what I consider a wonderful, exciting, interesting life that's just full every day with stuff. And for, you know, it's like who would want to do that? Who has time to do that?
Now, if you did do it, would you feel bad?
If I did, probably not.
Okay.
Probably not. You know what I mean? I'm telling you, it's a practical matter.
Let's make sure your wife doesn't hear this interview.
Well, we started dating. Our first dates, we were 12 years old, and she's known me since we've been a kid. You know, we started
12 years old? You're kidding.
We started going steady at 16, and we've been together since. So she knows a lot of my warts, and she is fed up with some things for sure. But I think, you know, I think I have enough interesting people around me and our kids, our family, extended family, they like it, that she's able to tolerate my ill behavior.
Now, can you control your ill behavior, or do you simply like the game of playing with people's minds?
Well, Errol, this is what I'm trying to do now, is to try to say, can you do the correct thing, the respectful thing, the good thing? And so I'm trying to do it. It's just a test. And I'm trying to use my own narcissism to drive it, saying I can do it. And other people can't do it, but I can do it, you know? And, you know, once you out yourself like this, yeah, people are watching it and probably having a good time, you know, watching me twist in the wind in a sense. Because a lot of people know my behavior, so I'm sure it's somewhat entertaining, but I got to watch it. You know what I mean? So I'm trying to do that. I'm trying to be a good guy. It's not like I'm a bad guy, but I'm not a good guy.
Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting. You are doing your work. The primary reason for you to do your research and your book, and to, in fact, add some scientific layers to words and concepts. Is it simply because you enjoy doing it, or is there anything underneath that feels that you're contributing and that makes you feel good?
I think, Errol, that I do it because it makes me feel good, and that if it has a good effect on the world, all the better. But I'm not driven by, I would say, doing good. But what I will say is, with this knowledge, in the past couple of years, I said, well, let's try to do something very positive with this. So we've put in for several grants in the European Union and in the United States and with the military. I'm an advisor to the military, and I'm, you know, I'm part of the American Land Forces Institute. And the thing is, how can we use this to show that exactly how the nexus of genes and environment and at what time of life it happens, can we convince people to treat their children and their neighbors really well, especially when they're young, and to be on the lookout for very vulnerable people. So we're trying to apply it with experiments. It costs about $15,000 a person to do deep genetic sequencing and all these other sorts of imaging, et cetera. So we're trying to use that to improve ways that we have people come in extremist infantry situations, that they're the wrong people that can't handle that kind of stress are going in there. Not to keep them out of the military, but to make sure that they don't get into the small group extremist warfare.
Well, in fact, I would think it would almost be just the opposite, that you'd want special forces to be somewhat psychopathic and yet to be able to control them, just like security agencies. You want them to be able to be out there and yet still control their behavior.
Well, where this idea is firewalled. I mean, you're always a step ahead of me. That's great. And so if you look at small groups, 8-9 people in the regular small group type of warfare you need this band of brothers feeling. So there is a lot of empathy and connectedness with them, and it's very important. But for special forces like Delta Force, where you have lone wolves, These people are not, there's no advantage to have them, a band of brothers thing. They work better alone and probably would be better off having some of these sort of what would be psychopathic traits that they can control, you know, not all of them, but having some of them, so they're not necessarily connected. And that would make probably for a better, you know, Delta Force type of person. So it depends if it's a group type of situation or a loner.
How does one identify a person who's going to go to the criminal end and is going to be a Jeffrey Dahmer or a mass murderer? And since you identify that type of psychopathy as uncurable, what do we do with these people?
Well, before I really got into this, because we've been studying schizophrenia with genetics and imaging for years, and depression and Alzheimer's and addictions, all sorts of things. But leading up to this, I had a certain feeling about, you know, letting people, you know, can people be rehabilitated, for example, criminals. After this experience, I have changed my views somewhat. And the first thing is, there's a slice of these people, of these psychopaths, primary psychopaths, who have no idea what they're doing. They have no sense of real morality. And I've become less enamored with the idea of capital punishment, of the death penalty. But I'm even more against letting these guys out of prison once they're in, because they keep coming back and doing the same thing. So we have to have some way of dealing with them. I'm not saying tormenting them, but they can't come back in society. I just don't believe there's any evidence that they can be rehabilitated. It may happen once or twice, but it's those seem like contradictory things, but that's just, as you know, looking at the science of it and the behavior involved, that's more against the death penalty, but more against letting them out in general public.
Why against the death penalty? If they represent nothing but danger, why do we have the largest prison system in the world?
Well, I think it's culpability. You know, those primary psychopaths, they don't respond to punishment or anything like that. You're not going to fix them by scaring them.
Don't fix them, kill them.
Well, but I don't, you know, the real primaries who have no sense of morality, they have no idea, no sense of what they're doing is really wrong, that there's a culpability thing. So there's and what I'm saying is there's a group of them that have no idea what they're doing is really wrong. Now, there's another group that is so impulsive that, just like having to go to the bathroom, we have the free will not to take a leak right now. But in 8 hours, we may not have the free will. And there's a cyclicity to violent psychopaths that, if you look at it kind of like an addiction, that cycle isn't from day to day. It may take months for them to be driven again to it. So this highly driven behavior.
No,
like
but I understand exactly what you're saying. But if a charging, foaming, you know, a wild animal is charging me, he may be doing it just because he's hungry. I'm still going to shoot him.
Well, sure. No, I completely understand that. But the thing is, if you just go by, you know, the legal issue of culpability and understanding what you did was wrong, then I just believe that if we keep with that sort of, you know, principle and justice, and this, you know, Errol, it does lead to kind of a problem that's going to emerge more and more. There are some people who think that neuroscience, genetics, is going to help public policy and our understanding. And I don't believe that. I think it's going to make things worse because, you know, Lady Justice is blind, but there is no average person. Everybody's really different and in many ways. So to apply the principles, knowing that people are so different, and even on the normal scale, that some people have pretty wild traits, that it's going to lead to a conflict. And so I don't know what to do about that. And, you know, politically, I've always been a libertarian, so I'm conflicted about this.
I am also a libertarian, but Lady Justice is actually on Quaaludes. I don't know if she's blind, but she's absolutely stoned because I haven't seen her, you know, function normally for a long time. Jim, I would love, first of all, at another point to continue and with you, because you are, you're in California. When I come out there, I'm going to give you a call, and we're gonna share, break some bread. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely. I got a backyard, and I, you know, Cabernet or bourbon or whatever you want. And I've got a jacuzzi, and we can howl into the night and talk.
I love it, man.
We can talk about life as it is and would be.
That's great. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it, and look forward to that jacuzzi.
Okay, Earl. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. I want to once again really thank James Fallon for appearing on our show. Pick up a copy of his book, The Psychopath Inside, on Amazon.com or bookstores today. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, and remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Please, I want you to check out our other episodes on GluckRadio.com. I want you to go to Twitter and tweet everyone about this particular episode. Keep listening and keep sending in your feedback. Maybe you want to be on the show, and there's something exciting about your life. Till next time.